This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, the U.S. president says democracy will triumph in Ukraine. The Arab summit rejects recognizing Israel as a Jewish state. Gulf states responding to social media savvy youth activism.
As the challenges have risen, the governments have been willing to put sort of new limits on both political expression and on public assembly.
Iran and Iraq drive a spike in executions worldwide. And rising wealth not enough to raise a nation's health. It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yaffe. U.S. President Barack Obama says he believes democracy and the rule of law will triumph in Ukraine. Mr. Obama spoke late Wednesday to an enthusiastic audience in Brussels after meetings with European Union and NATO officials. He said Western powers do not have any plans to try to dislodge Russia from Crimea by force. But he said over time, if the West remains united, Russia will recognize that it cannot use brute force to achieve its goals. Earlier, Mr. Obama said the international community is united in its determination to isolate Russia because of its annexation of Crimea, and that the issue highlights the need for Europe to find other sources for its energy supplies. He said Russia's energy sector could be the next target of economic sanctions by the United States and the European Union. Mr. Obama told reporters in Brussels that NATO needs a regular presence in countries that feel vulnerable to Russia. He said the situation in Ukraine is a reminder that freedom is not free, and added that collective defense means everybody's got to chip in to maintain a deterrent force. Analysts are debating what prompted President Vladimir Putin to annex Crimea. VOA senior correspondent Andrei Dineshnura has this look at the issue.
Russia's annexation of Crimea has been described by Western nations as illegal and illegitimate. Columbia University professor Robert Legvold says for Russian President Vladimir Putin, the annexation is a question of legacy.
From his point of view, it would be a far more substantial legacy than the Sochi Olympics, which everybody's been talking about as something that he wanted to be his legacy. But to have brought Crimea back into the historical place that it has had in the fold of Mother Russia, I think he sees as probably the single most important thing that he will accomplish as president.
Legvold says Mr. Putin believes by annexing Crimea, he rectifies what he sees as the historical injustice of 1954, when then-Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev transferred the peninsula from Russia to Ukraine, then a Soviet republic. Wilson Center analyst Matthew Rojansky says by taking over Crimea, Mr. Putin has destroyed the image of Russia as being a responsible partner on the international stage.
But there's another image that he may care much, much more about, and that's his image at home as not only defender of the Russian people, which certainly the argument about defending Russians in Crimea and eastern Ukraine would help, but also as defender of a greater Russia, you know, of a vision of Russia which is more powerful and bigger and which is taken seriously perhaps more out of fear than out of love.
Brent Scowcroft was national security advisor to two U.S. presidents, Gerald Ford and George Herbert Walker Bush. Before Crimea's annexation, Scowcroft told VOA Mr. Putin wants Russia to be seen as a strong power.
Putin nurses a grudge because what he says is at the end of the Cold War, when Russia was flat on its back, we walked all over them, and we did it because they were weak. Technically, he has a point. We pushed the borders of NATO right up into the former Soviet Union. We denounced the ABM Treaty and so on and so forth. We didn't do it to weaken the Russians. We did it because we thought it was useful. But that gnaws at him.
The United States and its Western allies have imposed economic sanctions on Russian officials as a result of Crimea's annexation. Russia responded by placing travel restrictions on U.S. officials. Columbia University's Legvold says the crisis over Crimea could affect U.S.-Russia cooperation in such areas as Iran and, to a lesser extent, Syria.
In Syria, they've been a problem all along the way. They helped in an important way on chemical weapons, but the notion that somehow we can find common ground for achieving a political outcome grows more remote because, again, the Russians have no desire to seem like a cooperative partner when they are defining us not merely as misguided in our policy, but even malevolent in our policy, that is beginning to think of us as an adversary, not simply a difficult interlocutor.
Legvold and others believe if tensions rise between the United States and Russia over Ukraine and other issues, it could ignite a new Cold War. Andre Dineshner of VOA News, Washington.
Arab leaders say they will continue to regard Israel as an illegitimate state and have put all blame for troubled peace efforts on the Israelis. Philip Walter Wellman reports from Kuwait City, where the 25th Arab League summit closed Wednesday.
This year's summit was marked by deepening divisions among member countries, but a united stance on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict was always expected. Kuwait's Foreign Ministry Undersecretary Khaled Al-Jarallah read out a final communique at the summit's close, saying the Palestinian cause remains at the center of our concerns in the Arab world. The body condemned Israeli settlement expansion and what it calls the desecrating of Islamic holy sites in Jerusalem. We hold Israel entirely responsible for the lack of progress in the peace process and continuing tension in the Middle East, the declaration said. We express our absolute and decisive rejection to recognizing Israel as a Jewish state. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu had been demanding Palestinian leaders give such recognition during the current peace talks. Arab leaders also expressed their utter solidarity for the Syrian people and urged President Bashar al-Assad to halt all military action. They endorsed a peaceful solution to Syria's civil war. That was despite a call at the summit from opposition Syrian National Coalition leader Ahmad al-Jarba for the international community to provide sophisticated weapons to rebels. League delegates also pledged to work together to fight terrorism and promote economic activity in the region. The Secretary General of the Arab League, Nabil al-Arabi, on Wednesday admitted there were originally doubts over whether the Kuwait meeting would take place because of numerous disagreements between members over issues like Egypt and Syria. He called for solidarity in the months ahead. "We need to join forces for a better future," he said. At the summit's closing ceremony, the acting president of Egypt, Adli Mansour, also called for greater Arab collaboration, suggesting discord was undermining the League and preventing it from making meaningful improvements to the Arab world. "We aspire to reaching a day when Arab citizens feel the results of our activities," he said. Egypt will host the next Arab League summit in 2015. This is Philip Walter Wellman for VOA News, Kuwait City.
Egypt's military chief says he's resigning from the military and will run for president. With few viable opponents, his official status as the next leader seems all but assured. VOA's Elizabeth Arrett has details from Cairo.
Field Marshal Abdel Fattah el-Sisi appears poised to become Egypt's next president, following in the steps of Mohamed Morsi, the man he helped overthrow. Sisi has the explicit backing of Egypt's all-powerful military. Commanders say the people have ordered him to run. And indeed, the throngs that come out on Egypt's streets to support him insist he's the country's only savior.
"There is no substitute who could be a president at this moment in time. Anyone else would take us back to square one."
But that's exactly where his critics say Sisi will take them. Back to the kind of leadership Egyptians overthrew in 2011.
"This goes against all of what we've stood for, against the militarization of the state, against having a brutal dictator from the army rule with an iron fist."
Yet when Morsi chose him to head the armed forces in 2012, Sisi's reputation as a devout Muslim made his loyalties unclear. The next year, there was no doubt. Mass protests broke out against Morsi, and Sisi moved quickly. First against Egypt's first democratically elected president, then Morsi's Muslim Brotherhood base. The crackdown widened with secular activists, academics, and others in jail or exile. As a jihadist insurgency grew, Sisi's supporters grew more fervent. They compare Sisi to his childhood hero, President Gamal Abdel Nasser, who helped overthrow Egypt's monarchy. Some find him, like Nasser, charming. Lawyer and scholar Ahmed Kamal Abu El Magd.
"He's a nice guy. He's tender and he's compassionate and he has a good sense of humor. And he has experience with the secret agents of the country. But how this is going to work out. I don't know.
And that's the risk. Egyptian discontent is broad, fueled by chronic poverty, unemployment, and a breakdown of social services. Even a massive infusion of Gulf Arab money after Morsi's fall has done little to improve daily life.
All these people love him now, but when he's the nation's president for 5 or 6 months, they will curse him. Why? Because we are in a state that has fallen apart.
Reviving Egypt's familiar dynamic of a repression in the name of security has its own perils. Failing to address the basic concerns of protest-ready Egyptians may prove even riskier. Elizabeth Arrett, VOA News, Cairo.
Youth activists are bringing new forms of engagement to Gulf states, according to a new Atlantic Council article. Kristen Dewan, for her brief Breaking Taboos, Youth Activism in the Gulf States, looks at movements in Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, and Bahrain. We asked her, what are the political implications of the growing youth population in the region?
There's no question that we've really seen a pronounced rise in youth activism in the past decade. And these are really due to both challenges and opportunities that we find in these states. The challenges are really linked to kind of growing inadequacies of the welfare state. And these are linked to things like rising unemployment, challenges and delays in housing subsidies and things like that really hit the youth population the hardest. And the opportunities are really linked to challenges in the information environment, especially the emergence of internet-based communication. And this has really allowed, you know, through social media, youth to communicate beyond their usual social or political boundaries, so that we see this new kind of rise of independent youth activism. And this activism is really noteworthy for its kind of assessment that the current governments aren't going to be able to cope with the challenges. And so they're issuing much more direct challenges, both through kind of expanding the ways of contention in the states and also much harder political demands.
They're not going to be able to stop it altogether, though.
Well, basically, as we've seen this happening, I mean, and we really have seen the rise, you know, depending on the states and where they are. Like in Saudi Arabia, which is a much more conservative political culture, you've seen a lot of the activism taking place online, where they're just trying to build kind of a broader community to have a more national political discussion and allow for sort of more criticism and demands for reform of the government. And also just to open more space for civil society and to challenge sort of taboos there, whether it be kind of criticism of ruling family or whether it be social restrictions and things like women's, you know, driving and questions like that. If you move to other states like Kuwait and Bahrain, you know, the protests have been much more serious, really a lot more street activism. And we see in Kuwait, in fact, they were able to, you know, through sort of youth protests and things like that, to push both their elected parliament and against the will of the emir to actually remove a standing prime minister who was a ruling family member. And in Bahrain, of course, we had really substantial protests that had to be put down through both, you know, suppression, basically a lot of police action, and also the entry of Saudi Arabia to secure the country. So what we really see, if you look across it, as the challenges have risen, the governments have been willing to put sort of new limits on both political expression and on public assembly, trying to get better control over the situation.
If you'll just look in your crystal ball for us and look down the road, how do you think the youth will mold the future of the Gulf states? What will it look like in the future?
Well, it's kind of hard to see. And when you really look at the Gulf states, there's a lot of variation between them and sort of where there's room for reform. But there's no question that the challenge is really a generational one. We see just a really big transition happening. And this is actually a change we see, you know, globally, the shift in youth culture. And the Gulf, I think it's really pronounced as you see young people, you know, choosing more self-direction over control, a real preference for networks over hierarchy, and demands for more transparency over secrecy. And what's interesting is that's really affecting, not just challenging the state itself, but also, you know, other traditional social mediators, so people like tribes, tribal leaders, Islamic movements. All of this traditional leadership is really being challenged by this cultural change. So I think it's going to have really pronounced changes, you know, throughout Gulf societies, not just in the governments themselves.
Kristen Dewan, a visiting senior fellow at the Atlantic Council in Washington and author of Breaking Taboos, Youth Activism in the Gulf States. The human rights group Amnesty International says there was a spike in the number of death penalties carried out worldwide in 2013. The group says China topped the list, followed by Iran, Iraq, Saudi Arabia, and the United States. Henry Ridgewell has details from London.
A sharp rise in the number of executions in Iraq and Iran contributed to an unexpected spike in death penalties carried out worldwide in 2013, says Amnesty International's Audrey Gogrin.
We've reported on 369 executions carried out in Iran last year, which is deeply troubling, and a number of people have commented on the scale of executions in Iran. But we also believe that more executions may have taken place.
Amnesty reported 169 executions in Iraq. Somalia also contributed to the spike with 34 recorded executions.
Many of the executions that we recorded this year were in the autonomous region of Puntland. I would have to stress that the executions that we've recorded in Somalia as a whole are likely to be under-recorded.
Amnesty says it believes that China tops the list of numbers of prisoners executed every year, with estimates in the thousands. Earlier this month, Zhang Tiewei, a member of China's top legislative body, said Beijing was considering reducing the number of crimes subject to the death penalty. He said an amendment to the criminal law is included in the annual legislative agenda, and they are considering reducing the number of capital crimes step by step. But China still keeps its policies on capital punishment highly secretive, says Audrey Gogrin.
Until the Chinese authorities start publishing death sentences and executions and making these public, it won't be possible to confirm whether their claims that they're reducing the use of the death penalty are in fact true.
The United States was fifth on the list with 39 executions in 2013, one place behind Saudi Arabia's 79. Pharmaceutical companies in the US have begun refusing to supply the drugs needed for lethal injections, forcing state authorities to turn to more loosely regulated companies known as compounding pharmacies. Several death row inmates have launched court cases against their sentences, arguing that the use of less regulated pharmaceuticals could cause significant pain and is inhumane. Last month, Michael Taylor, convicted of raping and killing a teenager in 1989, lost his court case and was executed in Missouri. Amnesty says a total of 22 countries worldwide carried out the death penalty in 2013, one less than in 2012. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
A jury in New York has convicted a son-in-law of Osama bin Laden on terrorism charges for his role as a fiery al-Qaeda spokesman. VOA's Carolyn Weaver reports.
A jury in New York found Kuwaiti-born Imam Suleiman Abu Ghaith guilty on three terrorism charges, including conspiring to kill Americans. He is the highest-ranking aide to Osama bin Laden to be tried in a U.S. civilian court. The jury of nine women and three men was shown video of Abu Ghaith sitting next to bin Laden and other al-Qaeda leaders the day after the September 2001 attacks. In another video from October 2001, Abu Ghaith threatened that a storm of airplanes against Britain and the United States would not stop. Abu Ghaith unexpectedly testified in his own defense, denying that he was a recruiter for al-Qaeda. He said his role was religious and aimed at inspiring Muslims to rise up against oppressors. He said he knew of no terrorism plots in advance. Jurors were not told Abu Ghaith was married to Osama bin Laden's eldest daughter in 2008 or 2009. Lead defense attorney Stanley Cohen said he would appeal. He said the judge should have allowed testimony by Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the self-described architect of the September 11th attacks.
There's evidence that this jury should have heard and could not hear. There's witnesses they should have had access to and could not.
Fordham University's Center on National Security Director Karen Greenberg said the trial showed U.S. civilian courts can try terrorism cases.
Terrorism cases fall between issues of war and issues of crime. There's no getting around that. And the challenges are somewhat different than in normal criminal justice cases. And the law has evolved since 9/11 to handle that. And the procedures and the law are able to handle these cases. And this case shows that.
Abu Ghaith, who is 48, faces a possible life term in prison when he is sentenced in September. Carolyn Weaver, VOA News, New York.
The death toll from a large landslide in the western U.S. state of Washington has reached 24, and rescue workers are continuing their search for about 90 people who are still missing. Zlatica Hoke reports for VOA Television, prospects of finding more survivors are slim.
Relatives of the missing have come from all over the country to help in the search. The state of Washington has sent members of the National Guard to help, and the Federal Emergency Management Agency has dispatched rescue experts to the slide area near the town of Oso, about 90 kilometers northeast of Seattle. Local police and fire departments have used sniffer dogs, helicopters, and technical equipment, including sonar, to reinforce search and rescue efforts. Travis Hotz, a local fire chief, said on Wednesday there were about 200 people searching.
We had a very challenging day today with the rain, and that just further complicated things. We continued our search and recovery operation on the entire slide area. Unfortunately, we didn't find any signs of life. We didn't locate anybody alive, and so that's the disappointing part.
Jerry Farnes is a survivor.
It's hard to see your house in pieces this big, and that's what it is.
The landslide hit without warning Saturday when a hillside near Oso collapsed after several weeks of heavy rains. In some places of the soupy terrain, the mud is 4.5 meters deep. The landslide is considered one of the worst ever in the United States. Zlatica Hoke, VOA News, Washington.
What is it like to study in the United States, and what do you have to do to get here? The Student Union is VOA's blog that follows students from all over the world as they face challenges and opportunities of studying at American universities. Log on at blogs.voanews.com/student-union.
Getting wealthier does not automatically make a nation healthier, according to new research. The study questions whether promoting economic growth is the best way to improve child nutrition in low- and middle-income countries. VOA's Steve Barragona reports.
Harvard School of Public Health professor Subbu Subramanian says the conventional wisdom on how developing countries should improve children's health is basically this.
Let's just go after economic growth and then everything else will just follow.
But he says that's not always the case. India is booming, for example. The country's gross domestic product, or GDP, the most common measure of the economy, has been growing by more than 5% per year for most of the past two decades. That's faster than most Western countries. But more than two-fifths of India's children are underweight, and nearly half are stunted. And that has not changed much since the early 1990s. Subramanian and his colleagues wondered if economic growth was failing to reach children in other countries as well. So they looked at health surveys conducted since 1990 in 36 low- and middle-income countries, mostly in sub-Saharan Africa. Writing in the journal The Lancet Global Health, they found that when they compared the impact of GDP growth on indicators of child malnutrition, like stunted growth and being underweight, the effect was
practically zero to very, very small.
For every 5% growth in GDP, there was a less than 1% decrease in stunting, for example. Subramanian says that's because investments that raise GDP are not the ones that will improve child health. He criticizes India for building new highways and airports, while much of the country lacks basic sanitation. GDP growth needs to be funneled into clean water and sewers, childhood immunizations, breastfeeding promotion, and so on, he adds.
Without these direct investments, what we are seeing is economic growth by itself is not making much impact.
But the conclusion that economic growth has little or no impact on child nutrition drew this reaction from Lawrence Haddad, head of the Institute for Development Studies.
We think that's crazy.
Haddad says, look at countries like Vietnam, Ghana, or Brazil, where malnutrition has come way down in the last 20 years. Economic growth accounts for half of those declines, he says.
And the other half is attributable to strategic investment in water, sanitation, health systems, nutrition programs.
He says it takes both GDP growth and the right investments to raise child nutrition rates. Steve Barragona, VOA News, Washington.
Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington.
This is Today in History. On March 27, 1513, Spanish explorer Juan Ponce de León sighted land on behalf of the Spanish crown on the eastern coast of present-day Florida. He named the place La Florida after Spain's Easter-related festival of flowers. On this day in 1794, the U.S. Congress passed the Naval Act, ordering the construction of 6 frigates, the humble beginning of the U.S. Navy. In 1814, U.S. forces and their Indian allies, led by General Andrew Jackson, defeated the Creek Indian tribe in central Alabama in the Battle of Horseshoe Bend. The Creeks were forced to cede much of their land in the U.S. Southeast. In 1836, more than 400 residents of Texas were surrounded and executed as traitors by Mexican President Santa Anna near the town of Goliad. Despite that and the earlier defeat at the Alamo, the demands for Texas independence from Mexico only grew louder. In 1845, German physicist and Nobel laureate Wilhelm Conrad Roentgen was born. He is the discoverer of X-rays. In 1912, the wife of President William Howard Taft helped plant the first cherry trees around the Potomac River's tidal basin in Washington, the first of more than 3,000 such trees, a gift from Japan to the United States that remains a key tourist attraction each spring. In 1958, Soviet First Secretary Nikita Khrushchev became Soviet Premier. He was the first Soviet leader since Joseph Stalin to simultaneously hold the USSR's 2 top offices. In 1964, the so-called Good Friday earthquake struck the U.S. state of Alaska. It remains one of the most powerful ever recorded, up to 9.2 on the Richter scale. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States, Canada, France, Germany, Italy, Japan, the United Kingdom, and the presidents of the European Council and European Commission reaffirmed their support for Ukraine's sovereignty, territorial integrity, and independence. In their Hague Declaration, these countries strongly condemned the illegal military actions and annexation of Crimea by Russia. Russia's actions, the declaration affirmed, will have significant consequences. In addition to the sanctions already imposed, the U.S. and its allies remain ready to implement additional sanctions that would have a significant impact on the Russian economy. Russia can choose to avoid these consequences, but it must take actions now. Russia must respect Ukraine's territorial integrity and sovereignty, begin discussions with the government of Ukraine, and accept offers of international mediation and monitoring to address legitimate concerns. The leaders of the G7, the United States, Canada, France, Germany, Italy, and Japan, announced that they will not participate in the planned G8 summit in Sochi, Russia. We will suspend our participation in the G8 until Russia changes course and the environment comes back to where the G8 is able to have a meaningful discussion, and will meet again in G7 format at the same time as planned in June 2014 in Brussels. G7 members will also meet to discuss ways to strengthen their collective energy security. Mindful of Ukraine's economic situation, the G7 strongly supports the International Monetary Fund's efforts to lessen the country's economic vulnerabilities and better integrate the country as a market economy in a multilateral system. The G7 strongly supports the Ukrainian government's ambitious political reform agenda that includes constitutional reform, free and fair presidential elections in May, promotion of human rights, and respect of national minorities. The United States and its allies remain firm in their support for the people of Ukraine, who seek to restore unity, democracy, political stability, and economic prosperity to their country.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.